Blog Talk Radio.
Welcome, welcome, my friends, all of our wonderful book lovers, and everybody who appreciates and loves literature. Welcome to Blog Talk Radio's Off the Shelf. It is such a wonderful sunny day here, Saturday, April the 9th. And 2011, I want to thank you for joining us. Please run and get a friend, a family member, somebody you know who loves books. Ask them to tune in to Off the Shelf right now. They can do it over the radio. They can do it if they have a mobile device. They can dial in and tune in to today's show just by dialing 347-994-3490. They can come into the chat room. There's so many ways that you can tune in and connect and listen to today's show. I'm still waiting for our special guest to join us, but going to continue to move forward. I'm your host, Denise Turney. For those of you, if this is your first time tuning in, I know we have many loyal listeners. And to our loyal listeners, thank you. I so appreciate you. You have no idea how much. But for those who are tuning in for the first time, I want to introduce myself. I'm your host, Denise Turney. And I'm coming to you live from Philadelphia, Pennsylvania. They call this the city of brotherly love. And again, I thank you. Thank you for your support. Please don't let another day pass before you pick up a copy of Long Walk Up. I'm telling you, this book is incredibly powerful and moving. And this is words coming from readers who have read the book. It's my latest. I'm working on a new book even now. But these comments that I'm making are coming from people who read the book. Some of them major players in the media, and these are people who are saying themselves, this is a powerfully moving, uplifting, encouraging book that if you wonder if you can achieve your dreams, if you wonder if it's worth it to keep moving forward, you read Long Walk Up, and you will get that second wind. It's a story about a little girl in East Africa. She's orphaned after her mother passes away from malaria, and she has a long, hard road to travel from 6 years old to reach her destiny. And I'm thinking about people like a Harriet Tubman type things that Joan of Arc accomplished. This woman goes on to become Africa's first woman president. This is a book you just have to get. You need to bless yourself with this book. And you can get a copy of Long Walk Up today by visiting www.chistell.com. You can also pick up a copy of Long Walk Up at Amazon, Barnes & Noble, Border, Walmart, any bookstore. If you don't see it on the bookstore shelves, just ask the clerk for it. Just walk up to the clerk, say you want to order a copy of Long Walk Up by Denise Turney, and they can get a copy for you because it's carried by the largest book distributors in the world. And I'm still waiting for our special guest to dial in. This has happened a couple of times, not often before, but I always say I never know what's going on in someone else's life. I had one guest who came on once a few minutes late, but she had told me that she got a flat tire. She was traveling, and she had a flat tire, and so she had to take care of that on the side of the highway, and then she was able to dial in. So I never know what's going on in a guest's life might cause them to have to dial in late or possibly not even be able to dial in at all. I do hope that our special guest can make it today. Just to give you an introduction on her, her name is Patty Lacey. She is a graduate of Baylor University, and she's from she's a former Heartland Community College instructor. She's a wife and a mother, and she's the author of the books. If you go to her website, I really love her website and her book covers. Was one thing I want to talk to her about when she dials into today's show. An Irish Woman's Tale, Reclaiming Lily, What the Bayou Saw, and The Rhythm of Secrets. And she's online, if you want to check her out online, at PATTILACY.com. Again, that's PATTILACY.com. And I'm going to try to shoot her a quick email, even as I'm on now. She did confirm that she was going to be on today's show. So, again, I'm not sure what's going on to cause her to be late dialing in to the show today. I don't want to have blank space on the show either. I'm trying to send her an email. Let's see. Let me, I'm trying to think of something. For those of you, the romance book writers conference. I believe that is going on this weekend. One thing I've learned as a host of Off the Shelf, you got to be prepared for anything, anything and everything. I guess anybody who works in the media, they have to be prepared for if a guest is not able to make it, you have to be prepared to keep that show going. Regardless of what you're doing, you have to be prepared to keep it moving. I'm going back out to her again. She did say she was definitely going to be here today. To remind her to dial in to today's show. Even now. But the Romance Writers Conference is going on right now. Okay, I just sent her a note, and I am back. So the Romance Writers Conference is going on, and that was two guests that we had on the last 2 weeks, and who are romance authors. But what they told me is actually they changed the name of it, and I forget the new name of the conference. It's in California this year, and they have about 1,000 book lovers who come out. But they have major, major authors who attend the event who are on the New York Times bestseller list and other bestseller lists. The promo material I was sent for the interviews, I mean, that place was packed. And they move it to a different location every year. They do workshops. You can get if you've already bought a book by an author there, you can bring it. You don't have to buy another book. You can bring the book to the event and have the author, one of the authors, sign a copy of the books. You can actually talk to the author. There's a chance that people get to talk to best-selling authors that they would not normally get to do, to talk to a best-selling, New York Times best-selling author one-on-one. You can do that at this type of conference. But it started as a romance conference. I've never gone to it, but I have heard about it. It started as a romance writers conference. Then it changed because now they do science fiction. They do any type of genre, mystery, thrillers, just about any type of genre in the book industry. They now cover those genres, and they have those types of authors at the events now. And I'm not sure when that started. I do know it started as romance writers, and then it just moved and it expanded into they must have been other genres. And that was Pat Simmons. She was one of the authors, and Lisa Watson, and their romance authors, they came on and talked about the conference. They actually helped promote it, how they got involved with it. It was almost just something that one of them, and I think it was Pat Simmons, she got started with it first, and then she reached out and tapped Lisa, which is how Lisa got her first book deal. Pat was at the conference. She wanted to work on a new book, and the publisher said if you can, where they wanted it to be like an anthology type of a book, where if you could get a big name established author, and then go get a new author, somebody who's just coming on the scene, we'll cut the deal with you. And so she walked out of the room, and she saw Lisa Watson, and that's how Lisa got her first book deal. So attending these writers' conferences is good for authors. It can help you to advance your career. And I'm even as I'm on waiting for Patty Lacey, I'm going to Poets and Writers. I like to give our listeners, particularly our listeners who want to get their writing careers going, and I know we have a lot of people who tune in who just love to read. I love to read myself. When I moved in October, I actually got rid of several of my books. I had so many books. I just didn't bring them all with me. But I absolutely love, love, love to read. Poets and Writers is another good website. I'm actually on it right now for the authors and the readers who are tuning in to Off the Shelf. And, again, I thank you for staying with us as we wait for the guests to dial in. It's www.pw.org. Again, that's www.pw.org. That's Poets and Writers. It's a very, very good literary magazine. They have writers' conferences in there. You can find grants for writers in there. You can find awards, and some of these awards pay in the thousands of dollars. that you can go and apply for and get your name out there and start getting your career going as an author, again, as poets and writers. And I think Patty just dialed in. Let me connect her. Hi, is this Patty?
Yes. Hi, Denise.
Hi. We've been going about 10 minutes, and I was just going telling them about poets and writers always being prepared.
Well, you know what? I have on my day timer 11 a.m., so I apologize for the confusion. I bet we're on different. I'm on Central, and I bet that I didn't get that message. So I thought I was being organized. I'm sorry.
Okay. No, thank you. Thank you for tuning in. One thing I say, and again, thank you, when I've been doing Off the Shelf now for about 7 years, and I've learned to just go with the flow. I mean, I had a family emergency a couple of weeks ago, and I had to fly out of state, and I said, should I go on with the show or not? And I decided to because I wanted to for the author. So I continued on with the show, and I just logged in via my laptop from my brother's house in Tennessee. And I've had one guest who's had a flat tire on the way to the show. So, you know, people's lives go on. Our lives go on. And so I'm as a host, I'm always prepared to keep it moving and just give our listeners things that benefit their lives. So I was talking about poets and writers and a writers' conference. But since you are here and I have so many questions that I want to ask you, because I absolutely loved visiting your website, and I gave our listeners your URL for your website. So I want to introduce you again and then launch into the questions. So for those of you who are just tuning in or who have been here with us since 11 o'clock, again, and this is something you're going to hear me say so often, thank you. Our special guest today is author Patty Lacey. She is a graduate of Baylor University, and she is a former Heartland Community College teacher. She's a wife and mother, and she is the author of the books An Irish Woman's Tale, Reclaiming Lily, What the Bayou Saw, and The Rhythm of Secrets. And again, she's online at www.pattylacey.com, and that's spelled PattyLacey.com. Again, that's PattyLacey.com, PattyLacey.com. Welcome to Off the Shelf, Patty.
Oh, thank you. I'm so excited to be here.
I'm looking forward to it. After visiting your website and when I do the research work for each of our interviews, some of the book covers and some of the things I see at the website just get me excited to connect with the author. I want to start by saying, and I was telling our listeners earlier, the covers of your books, and I do recommend our listeners go over to your website so they can see what I'm talking about. The covers of your books are so eye-catching. And I don't usually lead an interview talking about book covers, but after I went into your website, I was like, wow, did you design the book covers yourself? And if you didn't, were you involved in that design, the process of designing those book covers?
You know, I was very blessed that Kriegel, the publisher of my first three books, allowed me to have input. And I think the readers would be excited to know that how Kriegel handles it is they send three alternative book covers to me, and then we start brainstorming about which one I like, which one I don't like. And Kriegel actually also sends to about 50 people, booksellers, stores, other editors, the same covers and have them say, you know, which one they prefer and why. So it's kind of neat. They get the marketing side's opinion as well as just me as the author. And on, for example, The Rhythm of Secrets, there were three covers, and the first one made me cry. I just opened it up, and it had the profile of a woman with her, mainly just her kind of a vague profile with her tensed hands on the keyboard of a piano. The second is the one that was chosen for the book with modifications, which was a woman and then a Mardi Gras mask and the piano keys. The third one I instantly disliked because it kind of made the woman look like a floozy, a flirt, and this was the pre-World War II period, so that's why I use that word floozy. But I instantly disconnected with the character's picture because I didn't feel like she represented my Sheba. And so we started dialoguing, and it was really cool to, you know, to develop it. And I really appreciated that about Kriegel. Some of the larger houses, like on my Reclaiming Lily, which will be out in October, it's much more driven by the publisher's desires. So
yeah,
you know, a lot of readers don't know that, that, you know, sometimes we authors have no say. Sometimes
yes.
we have lots of say. If
right.
you self-publish, of course, you can do it exactly
right.
how you would like.
Right. A friend of mine started out a book self-published, and it took off, and so she went with a larger house, one of the top 10 publishing houses, and they redesigned the book cover, and she hated it.
I know.
She hated
it's a hard
it.
Pill to swallow.
She went back, and she said on the next book, she's now with a different publishing house, but she told them, you know, I want some input because it's the author people think of when they see the book. They don't think of the publisher. They think of the author.
But,
so
you know, Denise,
like
what's interesting is that when I was, you know, chatting with my agent about this very question, she told me even Stephen King doesn't get to choose his own covers. So it
wow.
is kind of in the American public publishing world anyway. It is kind of the prerogative of the publisher, because in a way they do understand possibly better what will sell, you know, and what
mm-hmm.
readers are looking for. They have marketing information that we don't have. But I'm
right.
kind of with you. I mean, it's too bad there couldn't have been more of a compromise with your friend, you know, to find something she was pleased
mm-hmm.
with and something that they felt like would sell. And
mm-hmm.
I hate it when I feel like that what will sell marginalizes the story, you know, and what the image that pictures the story. And I think that's what we writers want. We want a reader
mm-hmm.
to pick up our book and go, wow, I have a feeling about this, you know,
yes.
and I'm drawn to this. And sometimes
mm-hmm.
our ideas are different than those of the money people.
Right. And then they've been at it a long time. So they, again, I think, but to allow input from both, but I understand they're marketing folks, especially the ones who've got the master degrees and 10 or more years at it. They do know what generally works, although they get surprised. They get surprised, too. You're a prolific writer, Patty.
Mm.
And when I interview authors who put out at least one book a year, because I generally publish a book once every 3 years, I tell myself, I got to get going. So that it's like a motivation for me. Your first published book was An Irish Woman's Tale, which was published in 2008 for our off-the-shelf listeners. And when I first saw the book,
mm-hmm.
I actually thought it was autobiographical when I first saw it in doing the research for the interview. But it turns out that the novel tells a story of another woman, not you, a story that was told to you when you lived in Indiana. Is that correct?
You're exactly right.
Why is the story's main character, a woman named Mary, why, Patty, is she trying to forget her past?
Well, she just can't get over that first memory. And that was what fascinated me about her story and others. And I went around and asked friends, and when I went to Barnes & Noble signings and had time to chat with the listeners, I would ask them, what is your first memory? Go back in your mental imagery and click back like an old movie, and what do you first remember? And sadly, a lot of times if those first memories of people were awful, in the case of my friend, it was people sitting around an oak table in a house on the Irish cliffs hollering, she's got to go. The little Egypt's got to go, which means idiot.
Oh.
And she just, you know, that was burned into her psyche. And so her whole life she was haunted, and she went on to be betrayed kind of by two mothers, not just one dysfunctional mother, but two. And, you know, I think that's a very hard thing for someone to get over and, you know, to be haunted by, literally. Even though she was a Christian and is a Christian, she just struggled to get past this and have some kind of, you know, settling of this. And so that theme kind of resonated me, and I started thinking, what if that were your first memory, and then you were shipped from the cliffs of the home, the only home you knew, and dumped into a home around Chicago and a very dysfunctional setting and different from anything you ever knew. You know, how would you feel, and what would you have turned out like? And so that's what I explore in An Irish Woman's Tale. I think those of us that have had, you know, more pleasant first memories, we don't understand this phenomenon. until you start talking to people. I know I met a college professor whose first memory was her dad throwing her mother against a wall. That has affected in enormous ways her relationships, her life. And so I think that I was hoping to educate readers on why people might be, you know, hung up, quote unquote, on certain issues. And I think it sometimes goes back to that first memory you have, which mine was a very pleasant one, you know, playing and my mom and dad coming in and, you know, look at the cute little girl. And many people have similar, you know, comfort memories. Maybe it was a bad thing like falling or getting hurt, but someone comforted them. So, you know, how it's different when you have a bad first memory.
Now, that is the first time I've ever heard anybody even mention a first memory. I know you taught. Did you teach or major in psychology?
No.
You're the first person I've ever heard.
I actually taught earth science and English. But, you know, I think I am a thinker like a lot of writers and probably you too. And when the thing that, you know, stimulated that was not myself. It was my friend saying to me, "What is your first memory?" And I looked at her and said, "I don't know. I've never really thought about it." And that seems to be a common response of people that don't have harrowing first memories.
What role does Sally Stevens? Now, Mary is the one for our off-the-shelf listeners who's she's trying to forget this horrible memory that she's got to go. And then they ship her off to Chicago where she doesn't know anybody. She's already coming from a dysfunctional family type relationship to go into another one. What role does Sally Stevens play in Mary's life, and does she meet Mary meet Sally while she's in Chicago?
No, actually, they meet in Terre Haute. You said that you thought this was autobiographical. It is very much for much of the book. My husband told an Irishman that we had taken to dinner this week that he felt like the book was 90% nonfiction. I basically just captured what happened between Sally and Mary, which was me and my friend, in the novel and changed some things. But when we God yanked us from our warm southern porch and dumped us in Terre Haute, I like to say, in 1995, I started a book discussion group. And it was after one of those meetings that this brave Irish woman hung around. And I thought she just wanted to nibble on all the southern living hors d'oeuvres I had made to wow the new people, you know, since I was the new woman in town. And but she really wanted to ask me that question, "What is your first memory?" So we met there in Terre Haute, and then 10 years later, God whispered for me to write her story. And we ended up going back to Ireland, and we learned the truth of why her Irish mother had sent her away. And so it was a wonderful experience of you know, being a little shy and thinking, "I can't write." I had never written other than embarrassing poetry and maudlin love letters. And my master's work, of course, in literature, you know, that kind of paper. But I had never thought I would be a writer. I had read extensively, and I think that's a huge plus for anyone who thinks they want to write. And I think I started reading at 4. I mean, you know, little bitty words. But, you know, I think that God had given me that gift of parents that encouraged reading and, you know, sat with me when I tried to sound out letters. And, you know, so that helped me learn to write. But I kind of started crash courses in writing. And you say I'm prolific, but I think it's just kind of making up for lost time. And right now I'm kind of at a place where I'm struggling to write. So I think all of us writers, you know, one way or the other, sooner or later, we'll have a period where we need to rest, you know, and take a break. But anyway, that first novel, you know, wasn't too hard because it was kind of just telling someone's story, right, getting it on paper.
That is really something. And then again, if you probably were a little distanced from the story because it wasn't your story. But I think as authors, we always put a little bit of ourselves. The material we write from, like a musician, if they create if they're not copying something somebody else did. Now, a lot of people just do they use a template, some type of a formula, type of a creating, whether it's music or a book. But a lot of people, not a lot, I would say fewer people create from what is within them, and that's what I call a true artist. And you need to have experiences to be able to draw upon to continue to create things that are new, or else you're going to just start duplicating work you've already done. But when you write, it's impossible to keep parts of yourself out, because the material you're writing with actually is coming from within you, the author. I want to talk about your next book.
Mm-hmm.
The title of, and I love the title, What the Bayou Saw.
Mm-hmm.
When and where in Louisiana mm-hmm. does this story take? That's the title. Your titles are really, mm-hmm. your book covers and your titles. When and where in Louisiana does What the Bayou Saw take place?
Monroe, Louisiana. And I had lived in Monroe when my family, we left Texas and ended up in Monroe when I was in the fifth grade. And we lived there until I went off to college. So I totally draw on my experiences of going through integration, of wondering why, I've shockingly learned our town was half African American. Well, where are they? Where are the people? And
right.
The incongruities I saw in treatment, even as a, I would say it started when I was in high school. I started wondering what about things, and I would ask my dad what the sign meant that said we reserve the right to refuse service, and just the whole situation troubled me, I guess. And when I went off to college in Texas, I said I'll never go back there to Louisiana in my mind. There were just something was wrong to me, even though I still didn't get it. And I'm sure I was not, didn't really act and respond in the best ways either. After I started my writing career, I talked to a woman that was the director of the Museum of Mobile, and she told me a heartbreaking story about living in the Toulmin section of Mobile, Alabama, and having a neighbor that was white, and she was African-American, mm-hmm. and they were never allowed in each other's yard, but they felt drawn to one another in that way
wow.
of little girls. And so they stuck toys through a chain link fence, and they played
that
for 7 years.
Wow.
Interestingly, the black girl went to private school at that time, so she would rush out in her little uniform. The other girl would rush out in her little, bow-tied dress, and they would just only be able to communicate through that fence. And I started thinking of the metaphor of how racism and fences and chains, the hideous stain
yes.
of slavery, has
right.
ruined natural friendships that can evolve. People just
wow.
looking at one another's face and saying, I like her, I think.
Yes.
And that these two brave little girls, when they grew up, they maintained contact and they're still friends. So
oh my goodness.
I just kept thinking, somehow that needs to be in a novel. And that's kind of how I write. I'm inspired by something like that. To me, that's a picture in my mind that's bigger than life. Like, just every day seeing those little girls come home and neither parent's allowing the other child into their yard. She was clear to tell me that her parents were just as adamant that a white person not step in their yard. And,
mm-hmm.
so it was a both-way feeling. And just the bravery they had, and yet the sadness that they couldn't hug or, share a popsicle or, which wouldn't fit through those
mm-hmm.
silly holes. And anyway, that inspired my story. That set the basis of it, of two little girls meeting in Monroe through a fence and being denied the privilege of playing together, so they snuck off to a bayou. And on the day
right,
that...
So this- No, go ahead.
Oh, the day that JFK was assassinated, something awful happened to them down at that bayou. And they make a blood oath never to tell, but one betrays the other. And the story goes on. They're grown. And anyway, I'll leave it at that. So it's very much fictionalized, but yet the core of it, I think, remains, true to that first image of what happened. That's really an insidious thing, even though no one was killed or, raped in that yard in Mobile, but the fact that they were kept apart by society.
Yeah.
And so anyway, I wanted my book to explore those themes on both sides. And I actually was so fortunate to have three African and American women that grew up in that time frame, and from Louisiana, and one from Normal, Illinois, because the book has two settings, to share their stories. And so it's kind of a collaboration in that book, and I was very proud of that, that you know, that I feel like I did my best to reflect in that story both sides, you know, with help.
And this is Sally Flowers, the two girls, Sally Flowers and Ella Ward, for our readers, our listeners who get What the Bayou Saw. You'll read about those two little girls, Sally Flowers and Ella Ward. This is the second time you had a Sally in your book. And the Irish woman's tale, there's Sally Stevens. And in What the Bayou Saw, there's Sally.
It's the same girl. She it's the same character, but she's just not married yet. Sally Flowers is her maiden name. So she has moved from her Irish woman, which was true. We moved to Normal, Illinois. You see how, like you said earlier, you know, authors always draw from, partly at least, from their experiences. And that's the hard part for friends and family. You know, I got a lot of flack from my family about What the Bio Saw because, you know, they would say, well, you know, your dad was a college professor, but he wasn't like that. And I'd say, I know. I pick and choose, you know. And we
and
writers
people don't know really that that's your. They don't know it's your father. I don't think most people know unless you say it. If you say it's a novel, most people wouldn't think to know that if you didn't tell them. Why does Sally recall the event that happened in the bio? It's like 30 years past. What happens? I don't want to give the story away and tell the readers what the day JFK was shot, what happened there.
Mm-hmm.
But why does she recall it 30 years later? Why does
that is a great question. And very early in the book, Sally is now a teacher at a community college. And you can say, da-da-da, I remember you telling about that. And one of her students faces the same crisis that those two little girls face. And she really likes the student. She's a very intelligent, though kind of a defiant, chip on her shoulder type of a girl. But Sally really likes her. And when she sees her going through the same thing, she knows that she's going to have to come out and share the secret that she's buried because she has to help the student with what she learned.
Wow. And I'm just getting ready to say, an Irish woman's tale. Now, in an Irish woman's tale, Sally is trying to forget. Mary is trying to forget this horrible, her first memory. She's trying to forget it. And then a woman by the name of Sally Stevens comes into her life and helps her.
Mm-hmm.
And What the Bayou Saw, Sally Flowers is trying to forget what happened here in Louisiana.
Mm-hmm.
So there's two books about secrets, and I'm seeing this theme kind of as we go through the interview for our off-the-shelf listeners running through your books. Why do you think, Patty, that each of us carries at least one secret, even for a little while, at some point in our lives? Why do you think we do this?
I think that Satan is at work, you know, roaring about, and I think that he loves hidden dark things. And when he can make us feel ashamed by things, especially when they're perpetrated on us, you know, that we really were not responsible for. But yet if he can make us feel ashamed or, you know, unwilling to come forward and be honest, that he can start a whole life of deceit. And a lot of people struggle with my second novel, What the Bio Saw, because Sally adopted a behavior of lying, which many people do when they face a crisis, like the book discusses, when they're young. And it's just difficult for people to read and admit, you know, that all of us lie in certain ways. And then to explore, why do we lie? Is it because we're afraid that people wouldn't like us if they knew the truth, or we don't want to dredge up things that have been buried? And, you know, I just found it really interesting. And I have one of those kind of secrets that, you know, it probably would have been better to come out, you know, early and get counseling.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, I had to kind of face it as I wrote this book. And it was so weird because I really hadn't thought of it in years. And it's interesting how things are repressed. I think sometimes to protect us, Sometimes we do it because we can't face it. You know, it's complicated. I don't, like you said, you asked me if I'm a psychologist. I wish I were because I'd probably understand. But I got fascinated with mainly the secrets that women keep and why they keep them. And every one of my books has a woman that's keeping a secret.
Yes, and I think it makes the book, it's sort of a mystery because readers want to know, okay, how is this secret going to impact this, the story, the characters, the main characters, the situation she goes into, her relationships, the people she's in a relationship with. They think they know her, but she's got this secret. But when as I was, doing the research for the interview, I thought, when you consider that each of us, every human probably has kept a secret at some point in their life, even from the time we were little kids, it could be a little minor secret, like I took the slice of cake and I don't want nobody to know, because it could be a small thing, but we all do it. We all do it, and some of the secrets, they really get weighty and heavy on us. But when you consider that we all do it, one thing is to if you face a secret, you can really get to know yourself. So face it. Even if you just write in a journal, maybe you don't have to go broadcast it to the world, but but to begin to deal with it yourself, it'll help you to really get to know you, because if you try to keep a secret, you're almost hiding a part of yourself. So to really get to know you, and also to realize for our listeners here, it can be helpful to know that you're not the only one who's had a secret. Everybody probably has. So then to get to know yourself, to begin to peel away the layers of that secret. So again, as Patty Lacey shows in her books, you can also even see how that effort to keep the secret, how it's impacted your life, and how that secret you have might help somebody else, as it did in What the Bayou Saw. And now I want to talk about your latest book, The Rhythm of Secrets. Here we go. The Rhythm of Secrets. Why did you decide, and I mean, this story, all of your stories are so incredibly interesting because of how you develop your characters and the things that happen to them. But in The Rhythm of Secrets, Patty, why did you decide to center the story around a pastor's wife? When I read about this one, I thought, oh, my goodness, I can't believe she went there. Why did you decide to make her the main character of the story?
Well, in the same way as my other stories, in the summer of 2007, I picked up the newspaper with my cup of coffee in hand, and soon coffee was dribbling all over, and I didn't even care, because I was captured by the story of a woman who had given away her child. She had been sent to a home for unwed mothers. And as I read how she never got to touch that child, she only got to hold that child when she was going from the hospital back to the home where she would give away the baby. And she looked at that cabbie who had tears in his eyes. He had great, greasy, leathery old skin and nicotine stains, but he knew what she was going through. And she looked at him and she said, through that mirror, the rearview mirror, and said, "Mister, will you go really slow? I have one cab ride to give this baby a lifetime of love." And I just thought, I couldn't get rid of that story. I just kept thinking, having my own two kids, what would that be like to face that? And so I Googled up Sandy Speraza, whose paper was in the Chicago Trib, whose article, I mean, and I asked her if I could talk to her and interview her and perhaps write her story. And so that, once again, a real-life woman and her dilemma forms the basis of another book of mine. And as you're a writer, as you know, Denise, you know, you have to find a conflict. So I thought, you know, how can I make this, like, the edgiest possible? And I already knew the setting was going to be the 60s because I had some stories of Vietnam vets that I wanted to weave into my next novel. I've always been intrigued by how those men suffered when they came home, and just that whole difference between returning World War II veterans and the Vietnam veterans. So I had that on the back burner, so to speak, that, you know, to weave that in. And so I knew my time period. And so as I just started investigating, I just thought, what would be the worst scenario for her to have married someone that would, you know, be shocked by this news? And having been raised in a conservative Southern Baptist background, I thought, let's make him be a very conservative, religious right type pastor, and that she has not told. And,
ooh,
you know, he has big plans for some things that are going on that I won't, you know, tell
mm-hmm.
about right now. But she has not told him about her past and her son. So, you know, that to me was just like, you know, explosive and about as much conflict as you could want. So,
Of course,
the son comes on the scene with demands, and, you know, she's got to make a decision. You know, is she going to help the son that she never got a chance to love, or help the husband that she loves, but he doesn't really know her? So I just thought that whole idea of, you know, she loves a son she doesn't know and a husband who doesn't know her. You know, what would happen when all this, you know, ran into one another in a big train wreck?
And then, too, when you look back over your life, and our off-the-shelf listeners, and I'm sure you as well, Patty, we make decisions with the material that we have at the time we make the decision. I tell my son, if I knew 20 years ago some things I know today, I would have made different decisions. I look back and I say, if I would have known, I'll go back, let's say 24 years ago, some of the things I know today, I would have made different decisions, and my life would have definitely gone down a different path.
Mm-hmm.
But you can only make a decision, but you have to make a decision like right now to do something. Or should I move or not move? And, of course, we consult the Lord. But sometimes you say, if I had known then what I know now,
mm-hmm.
I would have made a different decision. So in this story, hopefully the husband can come to see, hopefully, rather than getting caught up in, she kept a secret. If she had to make that decision today,
mm-hmm.
she probably would have made a different decision.
Right.
But based on the...
Oh, I'm sorry. Go ahead.
No, go ahead.
I was just going to say, so much of it is by societal mores, you know, like the little girls, you know, in the chain link fence. I
mm-hmm.
pray that at least in many areas that would be totally different today.
Yes.
The same with the unwed mothers, you know. There's not the stigma today in the treatment and the denigration that occurs with women that are facing this that there was in the 60s. So, you know, like you said, women have to deal with the cards they're given at that time, and sometimes it's a very tight deck. You know, they don't have a lot of
mm-hmm.
options. And, you know, the society's constantly changing, in some ways good and some ways bad. And, you know, in some extent, you are the product of what people forced you to be, you know. So, you know, I try not to be too hard on myself with certain mistakes, even though, you know, like you said, we do think about what it could have been, but a lot of times we really might not have had the choices we think we might have.
Yeah, good point. How do you address keeping secrets in your stories, Patty? Do you show your characters, if they're keeping secrets, as if they're living a lie? Or do you show it as if they're simply concealing information? Because that's going to impact how the reader looks at the character, I would imagine.
Right. I think in the what the bio saw, she was living a lie, and that perhaps was a little distancing to some readers, especially those that don't admit that they've never done that. And maybe they haven't, you know, that they haven't been
mm-hmm.
Up front, you know, their whole life. But I think in this book with The Rhythm of Secrets, it was much more about her truly trying to protect the people she loved, because she knew that the information would hurt her husband. And I think this character of all my books so far was the most selfless character, and a brave woman really trying to do what would be best for the people she loved. And so she knew that the information would hurt her husband. And as the reader reads the book and goes back into the story, they learn that she really did try to tell him at one time during a real key, passionate scene. And, you know, he insisted it didn't matter. Nothing mattered but, you know, their love. And I know all of us have heard that kind of thing, you know. And and I think she accepted it. I mean, she wanted to hear it, and she wanted to believe it. And then when he said it and, you know, insisted that she not tell, you know, that was just kind of her out. And she probably felt it was God's will, you know.
Yes. Wow. In the book you're working on now, Reclaiming Lily, this book is a little different to me than your other books, An Irish Woman's Tale with the Bayou Saw, and the story we just discussed here. And I'm getting The Rhythm of Secrets. Now, in the book you're working on now, Reclaiming mm-hmm. Lily, mm-hmm. and we're interviewing for Off the Shelf listeners who just tuned in, Patty Lacey. She is mm-hmm. the author of the books An Irish Woman's Tale, Reclaiming Lily, which we're getting ready to talk about, with the Bayou Saw and The Rhythm of Secrets. And she's online. I encourage you to visit her online at pattylacey.com, PattyLacey.com. Now, in Reclaiming Lily, mm-hmm. I said, wow, she's sort of taken a different... gone down a different avenue with this book. You go to China. You venture to China in Reclaiming Lily. Why did you decide to write a story that's set in a different culture and country?
Well, once again, it's based on that true life story that I can't seem to get out of. And my mother went in for a colonoscopy and met a Chinese woman that came from the same province where my mother had visited when she and my dad were Chinese missionaries to China years ago. Mm-hmm. And they were the first, and this is the way they call them, whether we like it or not, they just say white people, that came mm-hmm. to their area because it was a very remote mm-hmm. northern area of China. And when my mother came to from her procedure, the doctor was crying and said, "You have cancer. I wish I could tell you something different." And they bonded, and she said, "I'm going to adopt you as my mother because my parents have passed. And, I'm going to get you the best treatment that I can because you helped our city. You brought new ideas." And so that established this connection with me, with this famous Dr. Kai, who called me on a Sunday and told me, once again, a heart-wrenching story of how she and her two sisters, and she was 11 or 12 years old, and post-cultural revolution in China, they had to make a vow, a sworn oath with one another of how they were going to help their family survive. And at age 12, she was told by her older sister that she had to be a doctor. And I just
wow.
could not get over, and she ended up in Harvard Medical School, and then in Tyler, Texas, where my mom lives and where they reunited. It just blew me away that at age 12, once again, a young girl would be told, this is what you have to do.
Wow, that is amazing, isn't it?
And the whole basis was you don't mind the sight of blood as much as the other two of us. And I thought, wow, that's the real reason to be a doctor. But, it turns out she has a gift, of a healer. And I consider there's healers and, divine physicians, and then there's just, people that have an MD degree. And she is one of these women that lives, eats, breathes, her patients. And that
wow.
is the inspiration for this story, even though it's a very small part of the story. The story
mm-hmm.
is really about... a Chinese family forced to give up their child for adoption because otherwise the mother would have to be given a forced abortion, which they do in China even until today. There's some of that. And
wow.
they take her and leave her on orphanage steps, and she's adopted by an American pastor and their wife. And then when this Chinese doctor comes to America years later and has an urgent message for her daughter, what happens when the cultures collide and the women collide. So
wow.
it's called Reclaiming Lily, and it's the point of, who has the right to a child? If you're born in one country,
mm.
does that country still have, and the people there, do they have the right, to access
mm.
to you? And, of course, the American couple is desperately afraid that their troubled teenager will want to go back to China, and leave them.
Mm.
So it's a conflict of the cultures, of the women, of the ideas, of one is Christian, one is not, at the opening of the book. And so, I really enjoyed this story. And once again, I don't know if you've read any Jodi Picoult, but it has similar themes to My Sister's Keeper. It's a
okay.
story about relationships between sisters and mother-daughter. So I think even though it has the Asian main character, and the southern pastor's wife, it's it could resonate with all women because of that mother-daughter. You know, it really talks about mother-daughter relationships and why they get so screwed up and what do you do when they're really screwed up and how can you fix them, you know. So I'm praying that this book will have an impact on women and, you know, of all cultures that could, you know, want to know, man, you know, I am struggling with my teenager, you know, how, why, and what, you know, the book explores that kind of thing.
Wow, just like Amy Tan's books, it's, that theme is when you that, you know, I think great writers deal with human struggles, and it's not so much where the person is born or their age or their nationality or their color or race, but when you deal with the human concepts and you really get to the heart of them, things that like in his plays, William Shakespeare did that, and there are other August Wilson in his plays does that. People
Toni
of all
Morrison.
Background. Will understand the story because you're dealing with human things that all humans deal with, and then it's a universal theme. On your website, pattylacy.com, pattilacy.com for our listeners, as we come down to the last few minutes, and there's so many other questions I wanted to ask you, but on your website you say this about Reclaiming Lily. It goes, Reclaiming Lily contrasts Christian and secular notions of sacrifice, compares cultural versus adoptive ties, and explores the tension between God's ordained plan and the dream of the individual. Now, Patty, I wanted to ask you this question. Do you think each of us, each person that's ever lived, living now, has a personal dream that conflicts with the plan God has for our lives?
No, I don't. I think that in this book, at the first, each relative, the Chinese doctor and the adoptive mother, have in their mind a preconceived notion of how to help this adoptive girl, and that's what I'm talking about. I think when you're a believer, as you continue to grow in your faith, you are constantly giving away your own dreams to just let God run the show. At least that's kind of where I am now. I mean, you know, people will ask me my dreams, you know, what's your dream? And, you know, sometimes I say I don't really have any because, you know, God's just kind of driving this train and he's doing okay, you know. Like this whole thing with this, you know, me writing that first novel, I never dreamed I'd be a writer. I did truly think that he whispered to me to try it and that I tried to be obedient and, you know, and that he allowed it to happen. And so if that makes sense, I don't operate as much now by dreams, you know, my own dreams, because my own dreams weren't really very godly at a lot of points. And I have seen that when I give up everything to him, not just my bad habits, you know, I think a lot of times it's not about just, you know, giving up sinful things that we know are sinful, but giving up the good for the better. You know, letting God run your show rather than, you know, maybe what your mom says or your friends or, you know, even what you want to do. You know, it sounds good. And especially with the worldview now, I think is so skewed that if we listen to the world's opinion of what we should do, you know, we should all be chasing the buck. And, you know, I think a lot of times God's plans are just better if we can slow down. So, no, I don't think that we all have dreams that, you know, conflict with God at all. And I think the more we give him our dreams, you know, the more we'll fulfill his preordained purpose for us. I do think he has an exciting purpose for everyone. You know the plans I have for you, plans to enrich you and not harm you. And I believe that. I think he knew us, you know, while we were in our mother's womb, and he designed us. And the problem is sometimes we don't like, you know, maybe the design. Because maybe, you know, maybe I'm meant to write only four books and no more, and he has another plan. And, you know, here I'm trying to fight in the tough world of publication and, you know, force things that, you know, maybe I'm done.
Yeah, no. We'll see. But, yeah, God's plan is I think the thing is to marry the two, you know, to marry our will with God's will. And then you're at peace. Then you're at peace. What has readers' response been to your three books? The Rhythm of Secrets, An Irish Woman's Tale, and What the Bayou Saw. What have you heard from readers about your stories?
You know, my stories are at a weird place, Denise. They are kind of on the edge of what a lot of traditional Christian fiction explores. I have great emails from non-Christian readers or Christians that say they don't want Christian books because they're boring. I seem to have a real good audience there, but a lot of people don't want to read, you know, some of the things I explore because they're not necessarily a sweet little sit down and get lost in a beach romance book. So I still feel like that God has called me. You know, He's given me these specific encounters with real life women, and He's asked me to write them, and I've done my best. And I try not to worry about the audience as much, and write for that audience of one. And every time I'll kind of pray for manna, you know, then I will get like a great email from a reader, and you know, but I don't know. My books are, I think in some ways my books would be, you know, and I've talked about writing for the secular market, but they're just so filled with spiritual themes that, you know, they just don't really fit there either. They're kind of stuck.
I think your books are, I wouldn't see them as basically Christian. I haven't read them, but just the research work I've done for them, they're more like, I would say, more on a literary side. You deal with human conditions. And that's what great literature does. When I was doing the research, it didn't strike me that these are like, you know, only for people who are Christian. I think anybody who's interested in the human condition could read and enjoy your stories, because you deal with things that are at the, again, that deal with the human condition. With only 4 minutes left, I wanted to ask you, because I like to leave our listeners with something that they can take away, who are, particularly those who are trying to get their own writing careers going, something that you have done. What advice, Patty, would you give to an off-the-shelf listener who's trying to land a book publisher, something that they might think is, like, absolutely impossible?
You know, Denise, my advice is different from a lot of people's. I would tell them first to read the masters like crazy. My studies in my master's level were African-American literature, so, of course, I love Toni Morrison and Gail Jones and a lot of readers like that. But go back, like you hinted earlier, to Shakespeare. Go back to some of the European and the great American writers, Wallace Stegner. You know, read, and then get good writing books and work. You know, a lot of them have workbooks. And until you have people, you know, writing friends saying, wow, this is so fabulous, it has to get published, you know, I would avoid all the game of, you know, going to conferences and getting, you know, editors and then trying to, you know, find an agent, because it is really hard and you need to have that work, you know, as the best it can be. I did benefit greatly from hiring an editor to edit my work before I sent it out. It was very expensive. It was $800, I think, but I think it gained me like 2 years of study, you know, in writing to have a professional
editor. I cannot say that enough. Oh, my goodness.
Yeah, I mean, I just think that's huge. And then, you know, to just keep writing for God, because I feel like when we get to heaven one day, you know, He may ask you, like that parable of the talents, you know, why didn't you write that? And I'd hate to say, well, I didn't think it'd get published, or, you know, no one was interested, so I quit. Because He told me one day, you know, isn't it enough that just I read it? And that really kind of stuck in my craw, like, you know, yeah. Like any artist, you know, do you do your art just because you expect reward? Then that's probably not, you know, a good reason. We know painters that don't worry about that, or, singers that aren't professional that still sing to the Lord in worship and perhaps at their church. And so it's a hard thing to do when you're pressured with, you know, sell and figures. Mm-hmm. But if your readers can stay grounded, I just beg you to pursue making your craft the best that you can. And Colossians 3:23 says, do all you do as if for the Lord, not for men. So, you know, write that book for Him and make it the best you can for Him, and then see where He takes it.
Wow. We have, thank you so much, Patty. I thank you for those encouraging and inspirational, uplifting words that you share with us. We have been, and we're coming down to the last minute of today's show, we have been holding a wonderful discussion with Patty Lacey. She is author of the books An Irish Woman's Tale, Reclaiming Lily, With the Bayou Saw, and The Rhythm of Secrets. Patty Lacey is online. Please visit her and support her. at PATTILACY.com. Again, that's PATTILACY.com. Her book sounds so incredibly interesting. I think I might go over and get a one of your books today. I have to sit down and think. I'm not sure which one I would get.
Well, why don't I send you one? Which one would you like?
No, I want to purchase one. I want to support you. Probably, maybe Reclaiming Lily. But anyway, I encourage all listeners to support Patty Lacy. Again, PATTILACY.com. Please come back and join us again. I'll be on this Friday with LaShonda Jones at 9 o'clock in the evening, and then on Saturday the 16th at 11, we will be back with another special guest, another author here on Off the Shelf. Thank you for supporting us, for tuning in. Please tell your family, your friends, your colleagues, everybody you know to tune in to Off the Shelf Saturdays, 11 o'clock, and this Friday at 9 p.m. We normally don't have a Friday show, but we are going to have one, LaShonda Jones, this Friday at 9, and we'll also be back on Saturday at 11 o'clock. Thank you, Patty. Please go support her, PattyLacy.com. As always, remember, you're so truly loved, so valued, and so blessed. Go out and create a wonderful day for yourself. Bye for now. Patty, I'll shoot you an email.
Okay. Thank you so much, Denise.
All right.
Bye-bye.
Bye-bye.